Coming up Saturday night at 6 on Hometown Heroes, this 94-year-old Delano man might have sold you insurance once upon a time, but what he did in World War II was a high-risk proposition.
A few feet one way or the other, and I could have lost that wing, could have taken away the control. I consider myself reasonably fortunate to still be here.
Hear this World War II Navy fighter pilot story and learn about his unique souvenir on Hometown Heroes. Saturday evening at 6 on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM KNZR.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we want to preserve the stories of our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice and make sure that we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. So each week we visit with veterans from our greatest generation. And today we're in Delano, California. For nearly 70 years, our guest today, Bob Bauer, has lived here. But growing up, you were up the road from here a little bit in Visalia, California. What was that like growing up there in the 1930s?
Well, there was plenty to do. We were growing up during the Depression, so we didn't have a lot of money to do a lot of things. But we found ways to do things that didn't require an awful lot of money. As soon as I was able, I became a wage earner to some degree, so all of my needs were pretty well taken care of, and I was able to help out with the funds necessary to raise the family. I was raised by a single mother who with myself and two brothers, so we didn't have an easy time of it, but we managed to enjoy it.
And we're going to hear about your exploits as a naval aviator in World War II. Your two brothers, did they end up serving during World War II as well?
They were both into the service. One was discharged for medical reasons. The other brother, who did a lot more flying than I did when he was younger, and actually was trained to fly gliders that were going to be used in Europe. I don't know all of the reasons, but for some reason or other, he never did make it over to Europe. He did depart from the Army and became an instructor for Army pilots in Visalia at the Sequoia Airfield, best as I remember. So he was a pilot instructor all during the balance of the war.
Well, who knows how many pilots he impacted in that role. And you mentioned that you became a wage earner early on. Now, my first job was delivering newspapers, and I think you did that too, huh?
Exactly. I did newspaper delivery for the Visalia Times Delta on a bicycle for 4 or 5 years. After that, I became the distributor for the San Francisco Chronicle for the towns of Visalia and Exeter and Tulare. So every morning I faithfully got up, delivered papers to those towns and to our customers there. This went on for probably 3 or 4 years until I left for the service.
Now, you talk about delivering newspapers on a bicycle. Would you ride all the way up to the porch and leave it there, or would you throw it from the curb? Did you have that accuracy down with your forehand and your backhand?
I could do pretty well after a little practice. I was a slow learner, but once I got the hang of it, I could pretty well put it where they wanted to. I didn't get too many complaints.
You never threw it on the roof like I did to Mr. Baird back in Los Banos, did you?
To my knowledge, no. I probably put a few in the bushes and other places that were hard to find, but no roofs.
So you graduated high school there, Visalia High School, in 1937, and you continued on in the newspaper business after that. When did you get that flying bug? What was the first thing that grabbed you about aviation?
I think it probably was maybe a little bit envious of my brother, who actually went to the Visalia Airport, did work out there, cleaned planes, and did other things just to get lessons for free, in essence. And when after I went 1 year to Visalia Junior College, then stayed out a year to work, and then decided when the government made an offer of flight training for junior college students, I went back to school to finish my second year of junior college, mainly because of the ability to take flying lessons and get a pilot's license.
And before all that, something happened that changed Visalia and changed California and changed the world a little bit. And I like to ask every veteran about December 7th, because it seems everyone who is alive has a specific memory of that day. I'm sure you spread the news to a lot of people through the newspaper about the Pearl Harbor attacks, but do you remember how you found out about what had happened out there in Hawaii?
Well, I could well remember December 7th. On that particular day, my mother and my two brothers and a friend of ours went to Bakersfield to visit with my aunt, who was a teacher there. Her father was living in a house in the back from where she was living, and while we were having dinner, he came in to let us know that he'd had his radio on and that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And that was how we knew about it. We knew that this was something big and that the ramifications were going to be with us for a long time. So we didn't affect our day other than we went back home and carried on after that, with the difference that we knew that having an imminent war coming on was going to make some difference in how we lived from there on.
Yeah, and as you shared, a little less than a year later, you decided to join the military. If you want to be a pilot, the Navy wasn't the only way to go. What made you decide that Navy was where you wanted to be?
Well, as I recall, one of my friends in junior college actually became a naval officer. I don't know exactly how it was, and I liked the way it looked, and I somehow or other, I had never had any contact with the Navy before, but I figured I had had my flying, I liked flying, I thought I'd like to give it a shot, and so I went through the procedure, and it was a lengthy one of becoming a Navy pilot.
Did you realize you were going to have to take off and land from moving targets called aircraft carriers?
Oh, yes. I'd read a lot about it, and I knew that it was that everybody wasn't going to make it, but I was going to give it a good shot.
And I know you are very active today at 94, and you're up on everything that's going on in the world, and you have a son who was in the Navy, a grandson who's a graduate of the Naval Academy at Annapolis, so you're hip to the room when it comes to the way the Navy operates today. How big a contrast is there to carrier operations in 2014 compared to 70 years ago?
Well, I can only gauge that by what I've seen in the movies and on documentaries of how the Navy operates now, and believe me, it's an entirely different world. It has to be 360 degrees to the opposite.
Well, I'm sure you made a few 360-degree turns and loops in your planes that you flew during World War II. And early on, you trained in dive bombers. Does it take a special mentality and special kind of chutzpah to fly a dive bomber?
Well, probably. It was you had to have great faith in your airplane, because in all of our training, which, of course, is all I did as far as dive bombing goes, was training. But it was extensive, and you had to dive on targets, and you had to hit, and you just hoped the plane held together. And, of course, you knew that they probably would. But we had I had a few that were along with me that, you know, that didn't make it. So it was not a piece of cake, but it could be done.
And the guys that I've spoken to who flew in those planes talk about those moments where they would black out, where you finish the dive and you're pulling up and you black out, and then hopefully you wake up soon enough to know where you are and be able to do what you need to do. Did you experience those kind of lapses of consciousness?
No, I never did. You could feel the pressure. You could feel what it was like it. But as far as it affecting my ability to continue to think, as far as blacking out, if you want to call it that, no, I never did do that.
Just got a little gray?
You could feel the pressure and feel the drain of the blood from your head. Yes, you could feel it, but I was able to live with it.
And I guess your first landing on a carrier probably wasn't the best omen for you. Didn't give you the most confidence that you could do this for a while out there. Tell me about that first experience trying to land on a carrier.
Well, that's one that you don't forget. We were on Lake Michigan on the Navy converted oiler or some sort of thing or other that they converted into an aircraft carrier just for the purpose of newly commissioned pilots learning how to land on a carrier. My first one was in an SBD. I made the landing safely, but as my tail hook dragged the wire, it hit a tie-down mechanism that was a steel girder across the deck, and the wood had been chewed away, and my hook happened to hit that steel implantation, and it tore my hook off. So my first landing resulted in me putting the plane into the crash barrier. But I survived all right. The plane had to have a new prop, but that was about it.
And when something like that happens, do they give you a hard time about it? Do the other pilots or your instructors heckle you or harass you?
No, there's occasions when they can do that, but on something like that, that your landing is perfectly normal, and it's just one of those things that nobody can avoid, there was no repercussion from it, no. No, there's occasions when they can do that, but on something like that your landing is perfectly normal, and it's just one of those things that nobody can avoid, there was no repercussion from it, no.
You just described a landing as normal. I thought there was no such thing as a normal landing. Was everyone different for you?
Well, they do become routine. You become, they caution you not to become too complacent about them, that everyone is a potential danger, but you do, they become so routine that you really don't think that much about it. It becomes routine, and you just hope for the best.
And you trained in those dive bombers, the Dauntless and the Helldiver, but you're... combat came exclusively in a plane that there aren't too many guys left who flew them, the F-6F Hellcat. What was your first impression of that airplane? What did you like about it?
Well, the first impression, I had flown F-4Fs, a fighter plane, in a training before, and the F-6F was just an easy plane to handle. In other words, you could tell what it was going to do, and it would pretty well do what you wanted it to do. It had adequate speed. It was a heavy plane, but it flew nicely, and it was nice to handle. It was a great plane.
When you'd been training for a while, and you'd experienced all these different airplanes, but there's a war going on this whole time. Was there part of you that was itching to get overseas, or were you content to keep training around the States?
Well, you kind of knew the procedures that you had to go through. A lot of people trained and trained and trained and probably never did get into combat. So in other words, it was a case of when you're in the service or in a war, you kind of take one day at a time. So you really figure, well, you do your best to do what you can do, and you hope that things are going to work out the way that you'd like them to work out. I was hoping to be able to get in to see some action. I really was. I trained an awful lot, and I trained for that. So my feeling was, I'd like to experience that also, come what may.
And a lot would come, and there are some moments that you came pretty close to not coming back and joining those more than 400,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war. Before we get to some of those, tell me about the journey to the war zone, heading out to the Pacific. Do you remember what your state of mind might have been or what that felt like for you?
Well, I know we departed from San Francisco Bay. My family was kind of there. They knew we'd be passing underneath it. And what they said they waved to me is our ship. I was actually on an aircraft carrier that had been repaired and was going to Hawaii. We knew we were going to the islands to do some more training before we went into combat. It was not like a cruise ship, but, I mean, things weren't that bad. As I say, I got familiar with a carrier without even having to land or take off on one by our 5 or 6 days, I forget what it was, voyage from San Francisco to Honolulu. So that was my first experience on a carrier, but that was just a passenger.
And your first taste of combat came where?
My first taste of combat, we knew we were going to do it. We were involved with the preliminaries before the invasion of Iwo Jima, and part of that included the Navy taking part in attacks on the island of Japan itself, to do as much as we could to neutralize any of their aircraft they had that they might send in, or to do anything to the shipping that was around that might be of aid to the army that was on Iwo Jima. So our attack was mainly into the airfields to see damage in, or destroy as many aircraft as we could. On that trip, we didn't find any. We had no opposition from flying aircraft. We saw some flying around that apparently were trainers, or certainly weren't combat aircraft. We managed to shoot down a couple of those because we were supposed to shoot at any target we could see, and an aircraft was a target. But most of it was strafing airfields and anything that might be a production to their war effort. We made two or three attacks, got some planes that we made. We're about to go back to the plane, to our carrier, but we said we'd had enough gas for one more trial, so away we bat back in. That was when we were strafing an airfield, and my memorable moment of that was just as we were pulling out, I felt my plane violently turn, and as I looked, I saw a pretty good-sized hole in my wing. Apparently a large anti-aircraft bullet or shell had gone through that. I realized I could still control the plane, even though with that damage to my wing, I had no control over my aileron for that craft, but I could still fly the plane. I didn't know how long I would, but anyway, we headed back to the carrier. I practiced landing with my gear down and looked like I could do it, so I managed to get it back on the plane. It wasn't a normal landing, but I made it safely. And they had the wing off and a new wing on, and the plane was usable before too long. But that was as close as I've come. The position of where it hit me was such that it didn't do any serious damage, but a few feet one way or the other, and I could have lost that wing because it would have taken away the control that holds out the wing. So I consider myself reasonably fortunate to still be here.
I'll say, and you describe that so nonchalantly, so matter-of-factly, but that could have been it for you. We need to hear more about this after we get back from our first commercial break. There's a special souvenir connected to that story that you just heard. You can find a photo of it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you can hear 94-year-old Bob Bauer explain it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Bob Bauer of Delano, California. He flew F-6F Hellcats in the Pacific during World War II with Carrier Air Group 9, flying off of two different carriers, which both took the name of ships sunk earlier in the war. He was on the Blue Ghost, the second USS Lexington of World War II, as well as the second Yorktown. They are both museum ships now. You can find the Yorktown in Charleston, South Carolina, and that Lexington is on display in Corpus Christi, Texas. When we left off, Bob had described an early mission in which anti-aircraft fire damaged his wing and was inches away from dealing what would have been a fatal blow for that fighter plane. You heard him say his guardian angel was looking out for him. And Bob, as a reminder of that, and you at home can see a photo of this at hometownheroesradio.com, but you still have a piece of that airplane's wing.
Yeah, well, I was looking at it, and the deck crew was watching it one thing or another, and they said before they took it down to the hangar to do repairs, one of the guys, several pieces of the wing were kind of loose, so he pried and pulled and took about the size of a dinner plate and a little smaller than that, took it off, and I've kept it ever since. I could remember that without it, but every time I look at it, it becomes a little more real.
I can imagine so, and it's impressive you've been able to hold on to it all this time after that carrier and another carrier and everything you've been through since. It must mean something to you. And I want to get more of that. If you at home want to see the photo of that piece of Bob's wing from that F-6F, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you'll see it right there. More about the F-6F. So you described these missions and the purpose of them, especially that one there at Iwo Jima. Familiarize everyone with the armaments on an F-6F. What do you have at your disposal?
This is from recollection, this is a long time ago. I know we had 6 50 caliber machine guns, 3 in each wing. We could carry best I can recall, a 500-pound bomb. I did that. And then actually, during the latter stages, each wing, they had brackets underneath them. So we had 3 rockets of some sort. I'm not that sure about the armament description, but we had 3 rockets under each ring. So we had 6 50 caliber machine guns. We had 6 rockets. Of course, they just fired once. And then we could carry a bomb. We didn't too often carry all of them, but we mainly carried the rockets, and of course the machine guns were always there.
And when you would go out on a mission like this, how many of these F-6Fs would go together in a formation or a group?
Well, there was always 4. We did a lot of what they call combat air patrol. Mainly it was to be instructed by the people that were operating the radar on the plane. If they saw what they call a bogey, or in other words, an unidentified plane coming in, we were sent out to do our best to shoot it down or to get it out of the way. We didn't have too many of those, but we did see some. We chased some that were apparently kamikazes heading in. They were hard to stop. They seemed to they would fly low, fly high. You didn't know, but that was the main thing. And as far as we always flew four together, but sometimes there would be four or five or six formations of four, depending on what our target was for that day, whether it was strafing the installations on Iwo Jima or on Okinawa or on shipping. We did a lot of combat against shipping. You'd think some of these ships would have sunk as much as they were hit. Some did. Some blew up. Some did not. But it was generally, there was always four together.
And I imagine you depended on those other pilots, and there was a fair amount of trust between you guys. It's not like a bomber crew where you've got multiple engines and other guys on board that can help you out. I mean, your only teammates are those guys flying the other planes, right?
That's right. They could always help you out. You also knew in that area, because, of course, this was towards the latter end of the war where we were so dominant, we had many submarines in that area. We knew if we had to ditch a plane in the ocean because of inability for it to keep flying, that there's a pretty good chance that within a matter of 10 or 15, maybe half an hour, there'd be a submarine right there to pick it up. As long as your life jack held you up, you had a reasonable chance of being safe. That's what happened to our president. He had to crash land, and a submarine had him picked up within 30 minutes.
Yeah, President George H.W. Bush had some very similar experiences to what Bob was doing over there during World War II. And let's get back to this Okinawa mission, where you nonchalantly described the hole in your wing and the piece that you still have today. So you said something there, if it had been this far over or that far over. Help us understand the implications. What you're saying is if it hit a more vulnerable part of that wing, the whole wing would have been compromised and you would have lost complete control, right?
Well, yes, that's, as you know, an F-6F have what they call foldable wings. The wings fold up against the side. And of course, there's a mechanism in the wing that holds it out in place when you're in flight. Now, if that mechanism were to be destroyed, your wing would, without it being held out, your wing would fold, and naturally you're not going to fly without a wing. And actually, the commander of our air group on that first strike on Japan in February, we're assuming that's what happened to him, because he crashed, never came back. He probably was hit with anti-aircraft fire, and it probably caused enough damage to his wing to his plane that he couldn't control it. We never did see him again, and as far as we know, nobody's ever found out for sure what happened, but we know he didn't come back.
And how sobering is that? I mean, and that's your commander. It's bad enough anybody, but the guy that you're supposed to be following his example and you're looking up to have that happen to him, how did you guys deal with that?
Well, when you're in war, these things happen. Fortunately, the next in command, it's kind of like if the president dies, you got somebody to step in and take his place. Our commander died, and so we had somebody take his place. But when you're in war, these things happen, and they don't perhaps have the effect on you that they might not otherwise. Naturally, you hate to see it happen to anybody, but it's something you live with.
And when you came back from that mission and saw the status of your wing and how close it had been, that gets your attention a little bit? Do you stop and ponder? Do you stop and look up to the sky and say thank you? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
That's exactly what you do. You said, thank you, guardian angel. And because that's, as I say, there's so many things in, well, not only in war, but in any situation, there's so many things that you really don't have control over. You got to have some faith.
So you mentioned the pre-invasion work at Iwo Jima. Did you have any concept of, or any inkling that would become the kind of lightning rod spot in the war that it became, and that this is a place that we'd still be talking about 70 years later?
Probably didn't know the complete implications that it would have. We knew it was big. We were flying over it, and it's just an amazing sight to see all the bombardment that the battleships and the cruisers were making to the island, then to see the Marines and their landing craft by the hundreds going into the shore. It's a sight that you never forget. As I say, our contact was there. We strafed the island. We dropped napalm on the island. We dropped bombs on the island. So we did everything we could, but they were so embedded that there was nothing that could make the landing any easier than it was. But it was interesting when they, after two or three days, we flew over the island right along Mount Suribachi. Didn't see the flag, but we presume it was there. So in other words, it's just part of the adventure that went with it, and felt sorry for those that had to make the landings.
Yeah, no doubt. So many Marines lost their lives there. And you touched on something that I was going to ask you about. Is it staggering or mind-blowing to you to think about how much you and all those other planes threw at it, and all those Navy guns from the ships threw at it, that there were still so many people inside those tunnels that weren't touched by any of that? Is that hard to believe?
Yes, it's hard to believe. I've seen documentaries on it, how they had everything embedded, how they were well prepared, that they knew it was going to happen. They had plenty of advance notice that it was going to happen. So they did a tremendous job of holding it till the last man was gone, and that's tough.
And with this being the first place that you really experienced combat, when you heard word that the Americans had taken the island, was that something that brought you some satisfaction or encouragement?
Well, yes, you kind of figure your side's going to win. You've got to try to be on the winning side. You were glad it was over, and you figure, you know, we knew what was coming next. Our next operation was the invasion of Okinawa. It was entirely different. The first few days went easy, a complete opposite from what was true on Iwo Jima. But then after we got inland, it became about as tough as Iwo Jima. We saw it from the air, but of course we weren't on the ground, so not being there is entirely different. It was a tough battle too, but we knew, given enough time, we'd be successful.
Were you ever scared, frightened, thinking you might not come home from a mission you were on?
Well, you always know that possibility. Anybody who's going to make them say, I'm going to do all I can to get out of here, doesn't belong out there in the first place. You know it can happen. You learn to live with it. It doesn't become a big part. Am I going to get back today, or am I not going to get back today? You know that probably the majority are, and that you hope you're in the majority. You don't ignore it. You know it can happen. And sure, it's a worry, but you can't let it get you down too much.
Did you have a special way of celebrating when you all did come back from a mission?
Well, yeah, you have your comrades that you join you with. We had a medical doctor that was, if you wanted to have a little heavy stuff to imbibe in and relax a little bit, it was available. You could do that. But other than that, yeah, you just say, thank goodness we got one more done successfully. Let's hope the next one is just as good.
I know you had some other close calls on some of those missions that I want to hear about, but you mentioned Okinawa, and one of the things that's closely connected with that battle, the kamikazes attacking so many ships off of Okinawa. And that was part of your mission, to try to prevent those kamikazes from achieving their goals?
Naturally, that was part of our duty. We did fly a lot of combat air patrol, which was mostly designed to protect the fleet as much as we could. There weren't that many out there at that time. They seemed to come at a little bit different times. We saw a couple of kamikazes come in. We chased one, couldn't catch it. It was just, of course, all they had was a pilot and a bomb. They'd taken everything else out of it and just enough gas to go one way. They were pretty light, and they could probably outrun us if they wanted to. I wasn't in the one, but we shot down quite a few. We probably shot down probably at least our group 10 or 15 kamikazes that never reached it, but a lot of them went through. Our ship got hit once, didn't do extensive damage, killed some people, but at least we were staying under float. It wasn't as bad as some of the carriers got hit real badly, and actually were put out of commission. None of them sank. They were all returned and were refitted. We were fortunate enough not to be on one of those that the casualties were pretty high on.
And so much is made when we talk about war. A lot of the focus is on the lives that are taken. But it occurs to me that in that particular aspect of your combat, when you're trying to foil the plans of these suicide planes of the enemy, that your job was really saving lives. Did you think about it that way at the time, or am I stretching there?
No, you're not stretching it. The more that you can reduce the enemy's ability to hurt you, the more lives you're going to save. That's the main purpose of our being out there. So naturally, you thought about that. We were trained to do certain things a certain way, and that's what we tried to do. If you succeeded, which we did for the most part, then you say job well done.
One of the things that I've gotten a kick out of over the years in talking to pilots is the stories where they get back from a mission and their crew chief or whoever tells them, how in the world did you land this plane? Because it never should have made it in. I think you had a circumstance kind of like that, where the shape you brought the plane in was not the kind of shape it was supposed to be in or could fly in. Tell me about that experience.
As far as the landing being unorthodox and glad to make it, that was the one I was referring to when I had my wing shot up over Japan. They were able to fix that plane and get it back into shape. One, I did break in that I knew I'd been near some anti-aircraft fire because it had rocked my plane pretty good, but it really didn't affect its ability to fly. So when I brought that one back in, I had mentioned to the people on the deck that I might have some damage because I was right near an anti-aircraft burst. They looked at it and found there were so many holes on the bottom of the plane that there was no way that they could fix it. So while I was watched to clear it out of the way, instead of taking it down to the hangar deck, they just pushed it over the side of the ship. It was unrepairable. But it really, as far as I had no idea that it was in that bad a shape, because it really didn't affect the flying. That's something I credit the stability and the worthiness of the F-6F for not having any more damage with having received what it actually did. It still was very flyable.
Yeah, that's a durable airplane. And you said you told them, it might have had a little damage. What did it feel like when that anti-aircraft burst happened just below the belly of your Hellcat?
Well, you look as far as you can see around it, there was nothing came through the cockpit. I was all clear that way. So I really thought, well, maybe it was just the effects of the blast. Maybe none of the shrapnel actually hit me. That's really, I actually harbored that thought, that maybe my plane had no damage at all. As I say, it didn't affect the flying of the plane, and we were kind of near the mission. In fact, we were on our way back to the ship when we were shot at. It was a non-eventful return until they let me know what had happened.
Just like a speed bump or something.
Just what it was. Like a speed bump. A big speed bump.
I imagine you feel it pretty forcefully. Does it lift you out of your seat? Does it just send the airplane upward for a little bit? I mean, what is that? Can you help us understand what that feels like?
No, you're strapped into your seat. You know, you're strapped in, so you're really not going to go anyplace. You realize you've had something very forceful hit you or affect the flying ability of the plane right then, but it recovered itself. So really, once things had settled down, and I thought, well, I lucked out again. But I lucked out more than the plane did.
I guess so, because it got shoved over the side of the carrier into the drink. That's a unique way of disposing of unneeded parts, huh?
That's exactly what's right. There's no, if they can't fix it, there's no. I often thought, you know, it's surprising that they didn't strip it to some degree, something that could happen, but, you know, speed is of exponents, and I guess they had enough spare parts and enough parts, so it wasn't my decision to make, even though I questioned the fact that they might not have salvaged some of it.
And it might still be down there somewhere under the water. Did you ever get attached to any of the planes that you flew that you didn't want to say goodbye to that one or have to fly a different one?
No, we really didn't have our own plane. In other words, the crew took care of them. We were told in our ready room which plane we were going to fly and where it was on the deck. We had no planes of our own.
You mentioned earlier on that that first mission, thanking your guardian angel afterwards. Are there some other moments where you felt someone must have been looking out for you?
Every time you make a safe landing on a carrier.
Did you ever have some crazy weather you had to land in?
Yes, we went through some typhoons. Nothing that was, you know, that was all that great. That we had some terrible weather that first mission that we made over Japan. We had to, instead of going in at the area that we had to fly pretty close to the ocean. There was so much overcast, but that was our way we went in. As far as the weather being a big factor, it did do some damage. In fact, the ship that we, when we finally came back to the States from our mission, was the aircraft Hornet, I think, which had had its carrier deck badly, badly damaged by the typhoon, and it was coming back to the States for repairs. So when we were coming back to the States to train a bit and then get ready for the next planned program, which was the attack on Japan proper, I mean the invasion of Bataan proper, well, that was the only aircraft carrier that we were on that was that badly damaged, and we were just there again. We were passengers from Hawaii to the States.
If that invasion of Japan had happened, what do you think the nature of your missions would have been? I mean, were you going to be low-level strafing against anti-aircraft guns? I mean, do you have a sense of what it might have been like for you had that actually happened?
We really don't. The only thing, when we came back, of course, we were assigned to different. I was assigned to go to the island, Florida. And I was in charge of a group that was actually training in dive bombers again. So that, as I say, they planned on using pretty much the same procedure as they did with the other islands that they invaded. Japan's an island too. So it might have meant softening up the island, using aircraft and probably battleships and so forth to neutralize it as much as they possible and then make a beach landing like they did in the others. I'm sure that the procedure would have been pretty much the same, just would have been the last step. And fortunately, we didn't have to take the last step as far as an invasion goes.
Very fortunately, because I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that you might not be here if that step had been taken, because as well defended as Iwo Jima and Okinawa were, the evidence says Japan proper was going to be even more heavily defended with people ready to fight to the death. Do you think that the dropping of the atomic bomb saved your life?
I'd say better than a 50-50% chance. As fortunate as I've been so many times, I can't help but think that my luck is bound to run out sometime. So, yes, I'm very thankful for the bomb, and there is a good possibility I might not be here had it not been dropped.
Well, we're glad you're here, and there are children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren I know are very thankful for that as well. We're also thankful you're sharing your story with us today. It's break time again. We'll get the rest of this 94-year-old Navy fighter pilot story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a multi-talented and impressive man. He's been an accomplished basketball player, a prodigious hunter, an insurance man, and apparently a really good neighbor, because I have to thank Peter Antonell for telling me about the guy he grew up across the street from in Delano, California, Bob Bauer. You might be questioning, as you hear Bob's voice, whether he's really 94 years old. He doesn't sound it, does he? And he doesn't look it either. Photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But let's get back to the story. You've saved quite a bit from the war. You've saved the what looks like Okinawan currency that's really a leaflet with instructions for the people on that island to surrender peacefully and not do anything that would endanger them. You've got photographs, telegrams, letters that you sent home. And when I think about home, you mentioned your two brothers and your single mother. I imagine your mother was pretty concerned for you while you were overseas flying those dangerous missions. What was it like when you got to see her again and she knew it was all over?
Naturally, it was a relief to her. She's a pretty much of a fatalist too. What is to be will be. That's the way what kept her along. She was a good mother, did a good job of raising three kids on a very limited salary. She was a teacher, but I can remember when we first moved to Visalia in about 1926, she got a job teaching, paid $120 a month. And that was for 9 months out of the year. So, of course, prices were cheaper then, but, I mean, we had to scrimp and scrape to make it, and she was able to. But she had all of her sons were in the service. I was the only one that was actually in combat, so naturally she was, if you want to say, she had more concern for me than she did for anybody else, but she handled it all right. She was a level-headed person.
You think about all those missions, the close calls, the guys that you served with. A lot of times when I tell people the name of this show, Hometown Heroes, they bristle. They don't want to be called heroes because they tell me time and time again the heroes were the guys who didn't come home. When you think about the guys that you served with, are there people that you think of and you remember as heroes, people that you looked up to or thought that they had a particular grade of bravery that you aspired to?
Oh, not really. We were all pretty much in there for the same thing, no matter what your... whether you were a commander or whether you were somebody just working on the ship, you were mainly doing a job. That's what, when we grew up, that was the idea. You had a job to do and do it. So I wasn't a romantic, so I didn't really think anybody was a bigger hero than anybody else was. Everybody was there to do their jobs. The lucky ones got to come home and the unlucky ones didn't. And of course, I don't feel like I'm a hero by any stretch either. I talk to people who ask me, and that's all I talk to.
Yeah, you never tell them that you've got a Distinguished Flying Cross and the Air Medal and other decorations from your service as a Navy aviator in World War II. And I would say, and I think a lot of our listeners agree, that it's the very attitude you just described, that you just wanted to do your job, that makes you a hero in our eyes. Because a lot of us wouldn't be here without you guys, and you have kids and grandkids who wouldn't be here if you didn't come home and if you didn't do what you did. On that note, did you have an idea of what you were doing it for? What your motivation was, why you were out there doing that job?
Not with any great ending to it. I know, as I say, it was a job. I wanted to do the best that I could. I didn't want to quit having fun. I had a good time with a lot of the things. I mean, this stuff was not so good, but really, I look at it as an important part of my life, something, the things that happen, I'll never forget. But as far as it being anything special other than living a life that you're not really used to. I enjoyed it, and I can't say if I had to do it all over again, I'd do it, because that can't be possible. But still, that's just part of my life, just like other things that have happened too. I think about it. I like to recall things fondly, and my time in the service, I'm fortunate enough to say I can do that.
And you said you don't think you could do it now. I shook your hand, so I don't know if you couldn't. You're in great shape, and you're strong at 94. What's your secret to staying so youthful?
Well, of course, good genes has got to be it. I mean, and taking reasonably good care of yourself. I'm not an exercise freak or anything like that. I'm used to getting up in the morning. When I was younger, I would get up early in the morning. I would walk to work in the morning. I would probably walk probably any place from a mile and a half to 2 miles. And I did that probably for 20, 25, 30 years. If there's anything, I can probably lay it to the fact I got a reasonable amount of exercise. I eat what I want to eat, and I eat when I want to eat it. I don't exercise like I do now, but I think that the time that I spent my 20 or 30 years before I retired at 70 and a half is the reason that I'm still going strong. Part of it, anyway.
That and a good woman, huh?
That and a good woman, yes. A happy marriage is the secret of success.
Anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is worth noting? Any other missions that stood out or that you felt particularly proud of what you guys as a group accomplished?
Really not. I mean, that pretty well tells the story. I certainly wasn't the headline maker. I didn't try to go out of my way to say, look what I did. And it was an experience that not too many people can say they've lived through. And so I feel fortunate to be able to say that much. But as far as anything else outstanding, no.
Well, you mentioned that not too many people have lived through. And that number dwindles by the day. Your generation is a lot smaller than it once was. And that's one of the reasons we do this show, so the rest of us can understand what it was like then and what it was that you guys did. What do you think that today we can learn from what America accomplished in World War II? Is there a lesson there for us that could inspire us or give us an example to follow?
There isn't anything that I can hang my hat on and say this is what we should do. I know the younger generation now is an entirely different world now. All the machines that they've got and the ability that machines have to think and do things for you sometimes concerns me, but I mean it's there and it's going to happen. There isn't anything I can do to change it. I just wonder if the perseverance and the love of country still is as much as it was then. I suppose if we got down to a real, real life or death situation like we had when I was there, I'm sure our people would perform. But we'll hope it never happens.
Amen to that. Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of your stories. And one thing I like to ask every veteran, as you look back, I know you're still looking forward to a lot of things, because like I said, you don't look or act 94. But when you look back, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
Well, of course, I'm thankful for good health. I'm thankful for my family, who has caused us so little amount of trouble compared to what we see some things going on. The happy family life, to me, right now, is the very utmost thing that I'm thankful for. I couldn't ask for anything more than that. We're so blessed to have that to live with.
You know, one thing I just realized I didn't ask you about, that a lot of Pacific pilots have spoken about to me, the way they felt about the enemy, the guys flying the other planes. What was your take on that? What was your impression of the guys that you were fighting against?
My impression was not a strong one. I mean, I wasn't out there when our enemy had their best pilots, had their best facilities to fight. We were there towards the end of the war. The ones that came before us, if there's any heroes, it's the ones that got out there when they were fighting probably superior forces than they were. When we were out there, we were the superior force. As I say, as far as thinking about the enemy, you kind of feel sorry for them. You realize that in all probability they've been misled the way things worked out. They're survivors, I know that. That's what made them so tough to fight. But as far as having any adverse feelings about them, no. We have friends that are Japanese now. In fact, we have a daughter-in-law that's Japanese. And as far as having any hard feelings against our enemy, the Japanese, no. And I don't think anybody harbors any hard feeling against them, even though they were our enemy at that time. And we were doing our best to get rid of them or to at least show that they shouldn't have done what they did.
Well, I think all of our listeners have gotten the idea and the impression that you're a pretty humble guy here. And just looking at an old newspaper clipping here, it talks about you shooting down three Japanese airplanes. I think you made a little bit of a reference to a couple of them, but not everybody that serves in airplanes in the war shoots down enemy airplanes. What were those three planes you shot down?
Well, the two were in our first deal over Japan. One was a trainer, and the other was apparently somebody training probably to be a kamikaze, because they didn't able, there was no fight. They just happened to be in my sights when I was after them, and a few bursts of my machine guns, and down they went. So it really wasn't a dogfight per se. I was happened to be at the right spot at the right time and caught them in my sights. Got two on that time. Then the other time was over Okinawa. There was one plane that was apparently flying from a field when I was doing some run over it, and I was able to chase it down and shoot it down. It wasn't a fair fight, but I did get my licks in anyway.
And you got credit for three. Now, I talked to a lot of guys who shot some down they didn't get credit for, and five makes you an ace. Did you come pretty close to being an ace?
The only ones I had another chance when they had us zeroed in on a kamikaze, that I was doing my best to catch him and try to shoot him down, but unfortunately he was in a lighter plane, and somebody else, I'm sure somewhere along the line, got him. But anyway, my other chance to get, and that was really the only chance other than these others that I was even had the opportunity to have an enemy plane in my sights. So I got the ones I saw and missed on one, but I wasn't in any danger at any time, which there again, me being out there when I wasn't afraid of getting shot down by enemy planes, because their good pilots were pretty well all gone by the time I got out there.
What about their ships? Tell me about your last action in World War II, because you guys as a group accomplished something pretty significant there.
Well, our Air Group 9 was pretty well credited with having the major part in the sinking of the one last big battleship that Japan has, the Yamato. And it was towards after the Okinawa was pretty well secured, and our people found where the fleet was, and so we were sent out along with other air groups also, but it was our torpedo planes that pretty well put the last did what it took to sink the Yamato. We with our fighter planes, we did some strafing runs on some of the destroyers around there, pretty well just covered in case. There again, you never know what's going to come in, so we always had to stand guard. So we mostly just stood guard and watched the action take place with the torpedo bombers and the dive bombers doing the most damage to the motor. In fact, the ones that actually did it in. But we did see it, and it was a spectacular sight.
Well, that was my next question. You say a spectacular sight, and I know when you grab that piece of your airplane, it brings back some memories. I have the feeling you can still see the Yamato going down. What did you see? What did it look like?
Well, we actually it was on fire, smoke coming from it, pretty much evidently. It did sink. As far as it actually sink, I think we were dispatched back to our aircraft carrier before it actually, some air group was there and kind of took over. I suppose they saw it sink. I don't know. We actually didn't see it sink. We just saw it on fire, and we know that it did sink. Sure, you remember things like that. There's so many things about the service that happened then that you remember. You're busy with other things, but it doesn't take much to bring the memories back.
Well, clearly, those memories are still very clear for you. Bob Bauer, 94 years old. And if you'd like to see some photos of the scene that Bob just described, the Japanese battleship Yamato on April 7th, 1945, I have some up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Just jump on Facebook, type in Hometown Heroes Radio. You'll also see a photo of Bob and his wife, Doris. You'll see what that piece of his F-6F Hellcat looks like. And a little more info on the Yamato. It was the heaviest and, to that point, most powerfully armed battleship ever constructed anywhere. It was from the bridge of the Yamato that Admiral Yamamoto directed Japanese forces in the Battle of Midway. The Yamato was also heavily involved in the Battle of Leyte Gulf and the massive battle off Samar. And she was on her way to Okinawa when the planes of Carrier Air Group 9 came after the Yamato and sank it. The atomic bomb was still 4 months away, but from a naval perspective, the sinking of the Yamato had the symbolic value of a knockout blow. If you see Mr. Bauer around Delano, make sure you thank him for serving our country. And if you're anywhere near Atwater, California, on October 29th, make sure you come out to the former Castle Air Force Base by 5 p.m. It hasn't been an active base for two decades now, but it's home to a terrific air museum there at Castle,
and the historic runway is going to roar back to life when close to 70 World War II veterans take off October 27th for the latest Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C. They're going to be returning home from that visit to the National World War II Memorial on Wednesday, October 29th. And the bigger, more patriotic crowd, the better. So if you're anywhere in that area, I hope I'm going to see you there that afternoon and evening, October 29th. We're out of time this time on Hometown Heroes. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.